that?
Now they like to come to some side.
Yeah.
Was Darwin a religious? He was a religious.
I don't know. Now, have I been clear so far? I'm trying to give you a course in intellectual history and show the Christian answer to it, and how these movements are vitally opposed to all of Christianity. Marvin? I'm delighted, not just because you're thinking, I believe in intellectual perspiration. In which the students sweat it out. My role is not to read the textbook to you. I give you credit for being able to comprehend English. Although you might argue, and some people say with great force, that this book is not written in English. It is, I assure you. I want you, when you enter the music and in the ministry, to be thoroughly grounded in the faith, with all the arms and the faith of Christian warfare, and for the training of your people in your congregations. I'm doing my very best. It may not be very good, but I'm doing the best I can to bring that to pass. Now, when I say things in this class, I'm not trying to ridicule another theological position. Nor am I saying that theological position is not under the umbrella of a Bible-believing group. What I'm trying to show you, when I stand for covenant theology, is that for me and thousands like me, down through the ages, it's been the only source of solace and comfort in the hands of a sovereign God, and the only answer to the constant cultural approaches of unbelievers as they would seek to demolish Christianity. This is, of course, an apologetics. Apologia in Greek means to speak for the faith. Covenant theology is the key to the whole problem. Now, the date for him, and I somehow neglected to put them in my book, 1632 to 1704. It should be, and I'm going to have to write Mr. Craig in time to put that in. 1632 to 1704. He was born 300 years before the election of Franklin Roosevelt to presidency. He was born 200 years before the second election of Andrew Jackson to presidency, and 100 years before the birth of John Dickinson. Does that locate him in history? And George Washington. Now, Locke was equally, if not more, unbiblical. Let's look what he sought to do. He was one of the first to realize the implications of the Newtonian system, and he wanted to create a new Weltanschauung. In English, what is that? A new world and life view. In other words, he wanted to use Newtonian physics, the Newtonian scientific revolution, as the basis for rewriting the whole culture of the West. A new theory of education, a new theory of psychology, a new theory of morals, a new theory of theology, a new political theory, a new social theory, a new economic theory, you name it. On the basis of certain basic concepts, which he thought were inherent in the empirical epistemology. Now, what do we mean by the empirical epistemology? Well, this is a mess. By that, we mean that everything you learn through your senses. As I state in the book, the mind is a tabula rasa, which is to say the mind is a complete blank. There are no innate ideas. There is nothing in the mind. Thus, the famous quote, all you learn through your senses. Now, let's look at this quote. It's from his essay on human understanding. Look, students, every man being conscious to himself what he thinks and that which his mind is applied about. Whilst thinking, being the ideas that are there, it is past doubt that men have in their mind several ideas, such as expressed by the words whiteness, white paper, sweetness, sugar, hardness, hardwood, thinking, motion, man, elephant, army, drunkenness, and others. It is in the first place then to be inquired how he comes by them. Where does he get all these ideas? I know, says Locke, it is a received doctrine that men have native ideas, he means innate, and original character stamped upon their minds in the very first being. This opinion I have at large examined already. I suppose what I have said in the foregoing book will be much more easily admitted when I have shown whence the understanding may get all the ideas it has, and by what ways and degrees they may come into mind, for which I shall appeal to every man's own observation and experience. Let us suppose the mind then to be, as we say, white paper, a molten mass with nothing in it, void of all characters, without any ideas. How come it to be furnished? Whence comes it by that vast door which the busy and boundless fancy of man has painted on with almost endless variety? Which is to say, where do you get the myriad of ideas that float through your mind? He says, you've got them. And you do. How have they come? To this I answer in one word, from experience. Note this, in that all our knowledge is founded and from what it may all derive itself, and that is experience. Our observations employed either about external sensible objects or the internal operations of our minds, perceived and reflected on by ourselves, is that which supplies our understandings with all materials of thinking. Then he goes up to elaborate it next. And this is called empiricism or sensationalism, by which he means that man learns from his senses and from his senses alone. In other words, the senses, your five senses, individually and in cooperation one with the other, work on the mind.
Christians would not disagree with that on a much lower plane.
He would. He'd have to disagree with it.
Well, we agree that sight, smell, and stuff like that, and we learn through that avenue.
What do you learn through?
So we learn what certain foods taste like.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I don't deny that.
On a lower plane.
I misunderstood you. Now note, the Christian view does not rule out the role of senses. Why? God gave us our senses.
Enjoy beauty.
Yeah, sure. I enjoy beauty. I love to hear great music. I love, yesterday, coming down, had a very interesting experience. I was booked to leave on an eastern plane. And, well, the eastern plane was to leave at 3:29 from Charlotte. I got there at 2:30. I saw the sign which said, and I quote, "The plane is to depart at 5:07. I was supposed to be here to speak for a party, a group at my daughter's home, and I thought, uh-oh. So I have a friend who is in charge of the desk and all the work at Delta in Charlotte, Mr. James Yates. Do you know him by chance? Well, he is one fine Christian man. And I went over and said, "Mr. Yates, I know what you can do. You have a plane leaving at 3:30. So I need to get to Atlanta for my..." He knows I go there to teach. I said, "But I have an earlier speaking engagement." And he said, "We have 8 people booked as extra already. Stand by." And he said, "But you go down there to gate 710 at Shaw," which I did. Now, after I got there, I don't know exactly what happened, but while I was just going to line to hand in my standby ticket, the phone rang from the front Delta desk, and the man there answered it. He said, "Oh, yes, yes, yes," and looked at me, and he said, "Now you go over and sit down and wait." And when they loaded everybody, they had about 8 or 10 empty places. Well, they called up name after name. I said, "Uh-oh, I'll never make it." Number 10 was called Dr. Greg Singer. Now, I can't prove this, but by that time, there were about 16 or 18 standbys at DC-9, which seats, 82 people. I thought, "Singer, your goose is cooked." But my name was last name drawn. And the funny thing, interesting thing was, I had a blue ticket, which is the white ticket on the Eastern. And he said, this is first class. They said, you will please take the first class seat. Now, I don't know what Mr. Yates told him, but I have an idea. I'll tell you what happened. 2 years ago, I first started to come down here. I was flying regularly at Dulles. They had the plane that left at 2 o'clock, 2:15 at that time, which brought me down right in time for my class. And I got to know him real well, and we would talk when he wasn't busy handing out tickets. He's a Christian man, and he asked me what I was doing. I told him what I was doing, and he was interested, and he was very courteous. He gave me courtesy to the Delta Club room there, and cold drinks and whatnot. And when the year was over, I wrote a note to the personal manager in Atlanta, thanking them for Mr. Yates. And I didn't do it for this purpose, but a son of a friend of mine is with Delta Airlines here in Atlanta, and he told me later that the personnel manager wrote a letter to Yates. In fact, he reproduced my letter and gave it to Mr. Yates. And so ever since then, Mr. Yates has gone out of his way to make me feel like a long-lost friend. And so when I went up to him, he just laughed at me. He didn't laugh at me, but he sort of looked at me and smiled. And I can prove a thing, but I have a funny feeling that that phone call was not accidental and had to do with me, because I could tell by the way the man who was calling the standby tickets looked at me that he knew exactly what he was doing, because they kept looking at the number of seats I had left, and the only thing was left was this reserved seat. And that's the way it worked out. A very interesting situation. I forget where I was. I lost my... Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, you do learn through your senses. But a Christian cannot accept luck any more than can accept enlightenment. Now, let me give you a phrase, which... This is more or less original with me. It's probably not very good, but for what it's worth, take it. The sovereign God created knowing man for a noble world. He gave man the ability to know and made the world able to be known. Have you ever thought to think, gentlemen, ladies, about the remarkable synchronization between our senses and the world? To smell a beautiful rose, to see a beautiful sunset, to behold the beauty, to hear beautiful music, to hear the baby cry, to hear the words, I love you, to taste beefsteak. By the way, what does it taste like? I forget. hear, sight, taste, to feel. I mean, have you thought to think that the remarkable synchronization between our senses and that which is around us? Now, God made the world to be known, and he gave us knowing minds. Now, I think it was one of you raised the point, sure, that we have senses, and our senses are to bring us into contact with the noble world. But how do we interpret the data of sense? That's the knowing mind. They're the innate image of God, which makes us able to know, and which Locke denied, by the way. Sure. There's no way for the senses to interpret the data of senses. Marvin, do you have a question? I did. It's the intellectual, image of God in man. It's resident in the mind. depraved, but nevertheless you still have it. I mean, the sinner hears, he can hear Bach, but he doesn't understand Bach.
You said that God says that ignorance at birth or devoid of all content.
Yes.
And further down, what do you mean then, you know, in the section right after the elephant army drunkenness?
Yeah.
The second sentence following, I know it is a received doctrine that men have native ideas.
Oh.
Well, no. What he's
speaking of the rationalist. He says what he's really saying. I know that the Leibniz and so on believe that men have innate ideas. In other words, he says I know that the contrary of what I say is received. You see, in his day when he was writing, rationalism was, as a matter of fact, Leibniz did not die until 1716. So that while Locke was propounding his ideas, Leibniz was still writing as a rationalist. Rationalism, while not in full supremacy of thought, was still very much in vogue, particularly in Germany. Empiricism was much more British than German. The Germans have always, and all ever since, have held to a much greater reliance upon the mind. That's why the Germans are good mathematics and related subjects, because they have not yielded to this empirical concept. Now some Germans have, but I mean, it never gained the supremacy in Germany that the others did. As empiricism did in England and later in France. The empirical attitude is one of the signs of the bankruptcy of the mind of a nation. And by the empirical attitude, I do not mean that to say that just because we believe in learning through the senses. The empirical attitude denotes the total dependence, or the theory that the mind, it totally depends upon the external world as it's brought to it through its senses and upon the scientific methodology. Now let me examine this with you. Let me examine Locke. If there's no question, let me really plunge into the depths of logical thinking. I want to ask questions. It may confuse you. I said, all right, you'll come out of it. I will not let you drown. I may watch you gurgle as you go down for the third time, but I'll lift you up. Let me ask you a few searching questions. How does any psychologist or philosopher or scientist know that the mind of the baby at birth has no innate ideas? What? He doesn't, does he? It's a postulate, which is directly contrary to Locke's whole point. He is assuming something you cannot prove by your senses. Right? So Locke has really defeated himself at the very beginning by making an assumption which is not observable by the senses. To begin with, what sense can capture the reality and existence of an innate idea? Now, you think I'm going to be very silly. Can you smell an innate idea? Can you taste it? Can you hear it? Can you feel it? You say, I'm being ridiculous. No, I'm not. Because if all you learn through your five senses, then obviously a whole concept of innate ideas must then be subject to knowledge brought by the senses to know they don't exist. Now, how does Locke's theory explain consciousness? It doesn't, does it? See, basically his theory is really depends upon the idea that even consciousness itself is dependent upon your contact with the senses. That, to put it in contemporary language, that you are conscious of me because you hear my voice. And well, to note more particularly, I make you conscious. The lights here make you conscious. The seats on which you're sitting make you conscious. The walls make you conscious. I bring consciousness to you. It's the impingement of the senses upon your soul, mind, which make you conscious, which raises a very serious problem. What quality does the soul have, the mind have, which makes it susceptible of being made conscious by the senses? Now, I'm not saying it doesn't have that quality. It's that something you can prove that way, isn't it? Let me ask another question. How do you know that you learn through the senses? And how do you know that you learn accurately through the senses?
Cold might be hot, hot might be cold.
And there are certain cases in which it is. You people who get frostbitten don't know it because it gets so cold, it begins to feel warm to them. Your senses can be very deceptive. I've given illustrations, some of you may have heard, others haven't. Did I tell you about my riding out on the Burlington Zephyr to Denver? When the conductor came to meet me in the morning, I was riding on the Vista Dome car, and it was about 5 o'clock in the morning. I got on the train in Chicago, I was going to teach the grade school in Colorado, and I was on the Burlington, and I got up and sat up in the Vista Dome, and it was a simply beautiful June day, gloriously beautiful. We were in western Kansas, and I thought, boy, this train's really made time, because looming right ahead of me were the Rocky Mountains. At least I thought they were, and the conductor came up just to get a whiff of the beauty before he, you know, got through his work. And I said, we certainly made time. Look, the Rockies are just ahead of us. And he looked at me and sort of smiled, and he said, how far do you think they are? I said, about 50, 60 miles. He said, they're 260 miles from us. And you could see them clearly as on the prairie. They rose right up out of the prairie, and the atmosphere was so clear that I had decided they were 50, 60 miles ahead of us, and I thought that train sure was going 120 miles an hour to do that from Chicago overnight. Well, it wasn't. He was going fast, but not that fast. It was due to the fact that I felt like I could practically smell the Rockies. We were so close to it. It took about another 4 hours to get there, 3 or 4 hours. I've been on Mount Mitchell and seen the shooting stars go by. And you feel like you can reach up there and grab them. They're so close. At least they seem that way. They're not. North Carolina, with a Carolina moon, the only real kind of moon there is. That's not prejudice either. See, you go out the railroad track and look down the track. I go down the station at Salisbury and look up, and the rails will converge above Salisbury in our sight. But if the Crescent Limit hit those converging rails, there'd be a big accident tonight. Because they don't converge. I've driven over Kansas in the heat of the desert in June, was 100 and 115 degrees, and you can see lakes right ahead of you in the middle of the highway. But then you never get to them. You know why? They're not there. They're mirages. Your eyes deceive you. Your ears that can deceive you. Your sight can deceive you. And so on. All your senses are capable of deceiving you. Now, I don't say they don't bring you the basis for information. But what does the mind do? It corrects and makes sense out of the raw data. Now you see, Locke made another admission, which I don't have in the quote. He did admit this, that the mind has the power to take simple ideas and make complex ideas out. And he made an illustration. I'll give you the illustration. I'm looking at Dwight. I see an orange sweatshirt. I see a blue shirt over the orange sweatshirt. I see not sort of a sandy hair. I see a sandy mustache. I see a sort of a sandy Dwight, a thin fellow, a masculine form. And I see, I get a group of simple ideas. Now, that's not to say that Dwight is simple. But you see, I get a group of simple ideas as to his physical shape. I've gotten to know his voice. I've never smelled him, so I can't locate that, but I hear him. I see him. I could come up and feel and get the touch of human flesh on him, and so on. I've never bit him, so I don't really taste like him. But you see, my senses bring to me a certain group of simple ideas. Now, Locke admits that the mind has the power to take simple ideas, like Dwight Wilkinson, and make a complex out of it and come to Dwight Wilkinson. Now, I don't deny the mind does that. In fact, I would insist upon it. However, I raise this question. By what reasoning does John Locke say that the mind takes simple ideas and erects a complex idea? If all we learn through our senses, then he cannot say that. If I can't see you, I can't see anybody here making a complex idea out of the simple idea they get out of me. Now you do it, but I certainly can't see you do it. I can't hear you do it. I can't smell you do it. I can't taste you do it. I have no way of knowing, yet I know it. See, he made another assumption, which is absolutely beyond proof by his own epistemology. You see? Now, the inevitable conclusion to Locke, as he went down through history, as some people tried to wrestle with him, like Bishop Berkeley, and correct him, he went to one extreme and said, a thing only exists if it is seen. To exist is to be seen. Which is to say that if I don't see you, Marvin, you don't exist. Only when I have sensual contact with you do you exist. He raised the famous question, if nobody's around and a tree falls in the forest, does it make a noise? His answer was that since no one heard, there was no noise. Because no one's there to hear it. Now, that is one extreme which Bishop Berkeley developed to try to smooth out the wrinkles in Locke. Yeah, but you see, is the sound only sound because you and I hear it, or is sound real because sound waves are created? By the way, how do you see sound waves? How do you know that sound waves bring sound? Oh, but you did. Did you learn it by experience? Now you see, you're talking to me. I'm talking to you. Now the theory of physics is that I create sound waves and you create sound waves and we hear each other. Now I'm not arguing that. But let me ask you something. By your five senses, how do you know there's a sound wave? Oh, that's all I want to know. Case dismissed. The conclusion came with David Hume on his essay in 1776 that there is no truth. He absolutely demolished Locke. Now, let me show you why. I've done this before, but let me, for this group, reinforce it. Hume established the point, and it's true if you think about it, that if all you learn through your senses, there is no possibility of having a scientific doctrine of cause and effect. Now, I did this. You say there's a cause and effect. Now, I'm not denying it, but let me ask you. The only thing you can see, you can hear and see my flipping the switch, and you can see the consequent fact that the lights go off. You see those two facts, but that's not the point. The point is, can you, by your senses, establish a doctrine of cause and effect? You know, you can. You cannot smell the connection. You cannot hear it. You cannot taste it. You cannot feel it. You cannot see it. The only thing you said to Locke, it's Hume, is to realize that there's a sequence of events between which there's no causative force at all. Now, if that be true, then there can be absolutely no scientific methodology.
That's not true.
What isn't?
That doesn't rule out.
Think about it.
What about the little boy that's pushing a wagon? You look at him and you see the wagon coming, and therefore you know it's moving because the boy behind.
Do you? Or you assume it?
If the boy quits pushing, it's not going to roll.
All right, what do you see? You see a sequence of events.
What you're saying is you could also establish that the wagon is pulling the boy.
You sure you could easily, just as easily.
Yeah. But you know the wagon has...
Do you? Huh?
I would say
you did. Sure you would.
Inanimate.
Oh, but you're making an assumption which is violates Locke. You see, you're making assumptions. Now, I'm not arguing against you. I'm pointing out that you are making legitimate assumptions which Locke would not make.
But he's doing
that
part of truth.
I would insist upon that. No argument. I agree with you. What you're saying is two concurrent events, a boy moving, a wagon moving. But as I forget who said it was, one of you gentlemen says that it might, the wagon might as well be pulling the boy as the boy pulling the wagon.
If you know the wagon, it's not half long. So
how do you know that through the senses? Okay, that's all I want to know. If all you learn through your senses, then you can make no pronouncement about cause and effect. See, you are bringing something in the picture which I admit, but which Locke would reject. Well, I admit I have problems. Now, may I bring up another point here before we... It may take 20 minutes or so. To further... show you the impact of Locke and what has happened. Now, Locke wrote two treatises on government. And the second treatise is the most often quoted and the one to which I shall refer. Basically, in this treatise, Locke held the following doctrines. All men by nature possess certain inalienable rights, namely the rights to life, liberty, and property. Point two. In order to further safeguard these rights, mankind entered into a social compact to create government. All government exists by the consent of the governed. All government exists by the consent of the governed.
All governed?
Governed, yeah. When government ceases to perform the duties for which it was created, namely the protection of human rights, revolution is justified. Now that, in brief, is the Lockean view of government.
Before.
He wrote this in 1690. He wrote in order to justify the English Revolution of 1680-89, the Whig Revolution in England. Now let's look at this from the point of view of biblical theism. There's so many questions I can raise here. To begin with, let me raise this problem with you. How do you know that we have rights?
Define biblical theism?
Yes, a biblical world and life view, the application of biblical doctrine to political problems in this case. How do you know, if Locke is correct, that all we learn through our senses, you can't possibly prove we have rights?
Well,
No way. No way! What does a right taste like? What's it smell like? What's it feel like? What's it sound like? You don't know. No way. Now, what is Locke doing here? He is making an assumption, is he not? Which violates his own epistemology. Now, how do you know that all men possess these rights? Or to rephrase, how can an inanimate nature itself, governed by a sovereign God, confer personal rights upon human beings? Oh boy, yeah. How can an impersonal nature, governed by a sovereign God, an inanimate, impersonal nature, confer personal rights upon human beings? How can nature give what it doesn't have? And how, by your use of five senses, can you ever prove that nature did that? How can you prove that these rights, if they do exist, are inalienable? How do you know something is inalienable? By your senses. You don't. There's no way of knowing. Dwight, are you upset? Am I working in vain? He didn't. He asserted it. Let me ask the next question. If all we learn through our senses, how do you know that mankind at some time in the past entered into a social compact? Let me hasten to add that no historian has ever been able to find that social compact or contract, as Rousseau called it. Now let me ask you something else. Is there anywhere in the scripture, is there any place in the scripture which mentions human rights? If so, give chapter and verse. And Armand thinks I'm denying human rights, don't you?
Talks about slaves being obedient.
Oh! Armand, face the music. What do you think about it? I appreciate your quotations, but I appreciate that. You've demolished the whole theory. Say that again for me. All right, but give them. Yeah, is that what does that do? That denies the right to steal, doesn't it?
Right to own.
Oh, yes. Correct. Now, you see, I never said they're not right, did I?
Wait a minute now, Dr. The fact that I'm not allowed to steal doesn't give you the right to own.
I would think it might.
You might not be able to own. You might be close.
Oh, wait a minute. The right to do something does not imply the ability to do it. I have the right. I have the right. I have the right to become a financier.
A what?
A financier. I do not have the ability. Many people have legally the right to become doctors. They have the right to go to medical school. But they don't have the right to graduate unless they perform to meet the demands of faculty. I don't have a right to drive an automobile unless I meet the driving requirements of the state of North Carolina. I don't have the right to become a lawyer unless I meet the requirements to join the bar. I have the right to go to law school. I have the right to buy a car. A right to own a car. I do not have a right unless I meet requirements. Now, yes, the poorest man has a right to own property. If he lacks the ability to amass property, that does not violate his right. Now, if you steal it from him, you violate his right. Now, let's go back to the main problem. Armand very nicely offered a solution in quoting from the Ten Commandments. But notice the phraseology involved in that particular passage in Exodus 20. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not covet. Thou shalt not kill. So on. They are negatives, are they not? Now, I would agree with you. Good exegesis demands that every negative there have a positive. I would agree, as Dick brought out. We do have the right to life. We do have a right to property. We do have the right to freedom, the biblical sense. Why? Because, as you suggested, Shirley, we have an obligation to live. We have an obligation to be free to worship God. We have an obligation to be stewards of our property. We are stewards. That's the whole idea of the prophet, priest, and king of covenant theology. Deny covenant theology and you remove the basis for a meaningful doctrine of human rights. And it becomes a total despotism. You see, every right, Armand and Clan, depends upon a prior God-given and God-bestowed obligation to live to God's glory. Every person has the right to marry. Because this may shock you. Every person, in my opinion, has the obligation to marry.
Without even raising a hand, what about in Matthew and Jesus says, he's talking about unity and so forth, and he says,
well, now wait a minute. I said, unless they suffer from physical impediments.
He says that the marriage vow is for those who can stand it. It's an extremely hard vow. Because the apostle says, if this is true, who is married?
Because
this is the one of those who can stand it.
All right, now, let's. I think maybe it might have crept in, plus a bit of weak exegesis.
Well, I don't know.
I
have a question.
Yes.
Well, Matthew 28,
you, that's your privilege. I will think nonetheless of you. Going back to Genesis, what does it say? Let a man wife cleave to his wife, let her forsake her family, and they become one flesh. Does it not say that? Now, that let is not merely permissive, it is a commanding permissiveness. In other words, let it be done, it means do it.
All right, but if that is perfection.
Perfection.
Yeah, if that is the idea of Jesus Christ,
didn't mean
it.
No, because he's the Son of God.
In Paul, in chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians...
What does he say there, though?
It's better for you not to marry.
Than burn, right?
No, not to burn. To save you the trials of marriage where you're divided. Your interests are divided.
Well, now, you see, you are right, but you've missed the point.
Well, I'm just trying to keep you honest.
Well, I
appreciate... That's the term.
Would not Paul
have
been
Paul was married. Yes. I certainly appreciate your efforts on my behalf. And I'm sorry if I've given the appearance that I need such efforts, but I'm not being honest. But Charles brought a very good point. You must remember that to be a member of the Sanhedrin, of which he was a member, you had to be married. I didn't say he wasn't. I said there, I don't use the word guilty, but I think your exegesis needs improving there. Now, let me hasten that. I would admit that there are states, there are supernormal situations where God has called a man into a duty which obviously does not permit the marriage. I would admit that he has called ladies into particular situations at times which does not include marriage. Now, I don't deny that. But you see, the sovereign Lord who enjoins marriage also enjoins what you and I would call the exceptions for people who are exceptions in his general plan, because he has a particular duty for them to perform. Normally speaking, marriage is not something to be picked up easily, just taken apart easily. Now, I'm not saying that for certain reasons divorce is not allowed. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying the normal human relationship.
Well, isn't that covered first?
No, not if, let me rephrase. If the wife or the husband is unfaithful, he is already guilty of covenant breaking. Thus, the wife or the husband, the case may be, is if the covenant is broken, then the wife is not guilty of breaking a covenant that's already broken, nor is the husband guilty of breaking a covenant that's already broken.
Well,
in two reasons, if the wife represents the bride as your offer of love,
it seems to me that you're going to
pay
for losing salvation.
I think you're not. All scripture affirms the security of the believer.
Well, then we turn that around and say, you allow for divorce.
Well, I have to do, listen, my dear friend, I have to allow what Christ allowed.
He said except for.
Oh, but the minute you say except, what is he doing?
Alone.
Oh, yes, isn't that a permission? I say, you can, I tell my children, you can do certain things except certain other things. Now, the accept is there as a prohibition, but you see, I allow you to go to the movies except on Saturday night, or I should say Thursday night, it's school night. What am I saying? There are times you may go. And he allows divorce when he admits that there's an exception to it. He's allowing divorce for the certain stated reason in that passage in Matthew to which you were referring a minute ago.
There are people that would use that particular passage as in the King James, I think it says, except for unchastity.
Mm-hmm.
However, the idea being that if the woman was not a virgin when they were married, I would see that she does not have a covenant until she's married. So it's not talking about that. It's talking about the covenant breaking.
It's talking about the covenant breaking. Incidentally, in the Presbyterian marriage ceremony, on the PCA and the Orthodox churches and so on, they still ask the question, if any man or woman knows any reason of any impediment to marriage, please let him speak now or forever after holy peace. That's due to the fact, this very fact, where there's an impediment which would involve a covenant relationship. You may not. I am not favoring divorce. Well, would you, Dick, my friend, would you have me prohibit what Christ allows? Who am I to prohibit what Christ allows? I'm not allowing it where he doesn't allow it, but I'm not going to forbid it where he allows it. I never forget what J. Gresham Machen said. When the church begins to forbid what the Bible allows, it ends by allowing what the Bible forbids.
Well, isn't it true that at that time they were considered betrothed for a period of about a year?
I missed the point of one word you said that I didn't get.
Well, the point I've heard on this, and I come to believe, is that when Mary and Joseph were engaged.
Betrothed is the word. I missed it. Yes, because he considered to be unfaithful.
But they had never married yet.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. That's correct. Wait a minute. Have you studied the whole history of betrothal in the Old Testament church in this case? Betrothal was a public announcement that they would wed. And it was a period in which they, although not bringing the marriage to fruition in the sexual living together, nevertheless were living as those betrothed to one another. They lived lives of complete purity, not only with themselves, but with the people around them. They were set apart. And it was actually the betrothal in the Jewish temple, Jewish synagogue, was equivalent to our marriage ceremony. The betrothal was the equivalent of the modern marriage ceremony.
Right, so they never actually came together.
Correct.
Right, now the point is,
No, you can't say that.
Well, but once they come together, it's different because they are one flesh.
That is correct.
How do you separate one flesh?
You can't understand the same expression in the name of Jones and Christ with the
holidays, one flesh.
That's right. Well,
You see, Dick,
they become one flesh physically.
And he says, how do you separate the two? Don't let a man separate what God has together.
Yes, don't let man do it, but when Christ gives permission, don't think I'm so strongly in the family tie, Dick. Don't misunderstand me. The point I'm making is this, that all marriage is a responsibility. We have four rights because we have four responsibilities. Rights go out of responsibilities, out of divinely imposed duties. Now, the very concept of responsibility is foreign to law. How do you know you have responsibilities through your senses? You don't. What I'm doing, students, is demolishing Lockean political philosophy, and in so doing, I'm demolishing the Declaration of Independence. What? Locke's political philosophy is thoroughly pagan. As a matter of fact, it's Stoic. His whole doctrine of human rights is derived from Stoicism. Locke was deeply imbued with Stoic philosophy and the beauty of natural law.
Aside, what are the four rights?
Life, liberty, property, and marriage.
Life.
You have no right to public education. You have no right to living in public welfare. You have none of the so-called rights which are rampant today.
Life,
liberty, property, and marriage. Because we are stewards in the covenant relationship with the sovereign God, by which we are prophet, priest, and king, by which we exercise the prerogatives as a result of the fact we have divinely bestowed duties and obligations. This is the only doctrine of human rights which can ever survive, because it places sovereignty not in the collective will of the majority, as Locke did, but it places the sovereignty where it already is, namely in the hands of a sovereign God.
Did you say the Declaration of Independence was formed on that?
I said it as a pagan doctrine.
Based on Locke's
philosophy. Now note, in the preamble of Declaration of Independence, the decay of Locke is already evident. He said what? Life, liberty, and what? Which is a thoroughly pagan doctrine. There's absolutely no clause in Scripture which in any way gives us a right to pursue happiness. Seek ye first the kingdom of God. Wherefore, O King Agrippa, I was not disobedient under the heavenly vision. Where's the right there? Our only right there is to follow the will of God, which is a summary of what I'm saying, because we are prophets, priests, and kings on the Most High. And in our Christian state, we have been given a new lease on life to fulfill those covenantal responsibilities. Now, I have examined Locke with you. I shall continue a bit of this next time, and then I shall go to Immanuel Kant and get further in this book. I'm trying to prepare the way and break the ground and let you see how this whole movement is developing into irrationalism. Locke is an excellent illustration of irrationalism. What'd you say? No. Yes. The government must follow dictates of Scripture to be just government. And when government creates rights which are not rights, it, by that very nature, detracts from the rights which we do have. This is why the whole modern movement for human rights is a totalitarian movement in neglecting and actually destroying our basic responsibilities. Denying our responsibility to God is destroying the rights we have and erecting a totalitarianism in its place. See, the modern state is at war with the family. We've established that thing. The modern state uses taxation as a means of theft. Therefore, it is stepping between you and your covenantal responsibility to render to God that portion of your income which he deserves and which he demands and which he has a right to exact. Right, yeah. And liberty, you are being deprived of your liberty to bring your children up and nurture in the admonition of the Lord. And you're being deprived of your property through many means. Mm-hmm. So the modern state, instead of being the protector of human rights, is its most deadly enemy.
In the area of life, too.
The whole abortion... I think that's quite true. You know, that was proposed by Auguste Comte, the forerunner, the father of modern sociology. We'll discuss him later in our book.
Well, in the Humanist Manifesto.
Yes, it is. Uh-huh.
Is there a right to suicide?
Yes. I had that at home. I did not bring it. I didn't think about bringing it. Let me have it at home. But you're seeing the background of all these movements. I think this course can be very, very helpful to you. I only hope I get through it in two quotes, which is very doubtful.